Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Democrat Andy Kim talks about his re-election to New Jersey's Republican-leaning 3rd congressional district seat and how we might begin to unify the country. And Philodanco founder Joan Myers Brown is named her successor as artistic director. We'll speak with Brown and Kim Bears Bailey about changes afoot at the Philadelphia Dance Company. But to begin, SEPTA is fast approaching a crisis situation. Since the pandemic began, ridership on buses, trolleys, and in particular the regional rails, has been in free fall. The transit agency has been losing an enormous amount of money, reportedly $1 million a day. And in addition, long-term funding from the state is on shaky ground. SEPTA officials say without an infusion of federal coronavirus relief money and a solid plan for future transit funding from the state, the agency will need to be reshaped and even downsized, drastically reducing what it offers to the commuting public. It's a troubling situation which could have an especially hard impact on poor communities. Leslie Richards is SEPTA's general manager, and she joins us now to talk about the full picture. Leslie Richards, good to have you here.
Thank you, Mary. Good to be here.
So let's start with the latest on ridership. According to published reports, the regional rails have seen the biggest drop in fares since the pandemic began. Where is ridership today on the regional rails?
On regional rails, we're anywhere between 10 and 15%, probably, you know, average at 12%. So it is quite low.
And give us a quick sense, too, about how it's going for the other services, trolleys, buses, the Broad Street Line, et cetera.
Yeah. So on the other modes, we're hovering around 30. Sometimes we reach 35%. But so overall, we're at 30% of ridership on the entire system.
So, Leslie, as I understand it, uncertainty around SEPTA's viability comes from the pandemic and a shaky long-term funding structure. To the pandemic first, how much coronavirus relief money has the agency received from the Federal CARES Act, and how much, if any, is left?
Sure. So we received $644 million from CARES, and we are estimating that that amount will get us through most of next year. We've already spent approximately $100 million of that, and we are predicting an operating budget shortfall of at least $350 million coming up this year. And then, of course, we have increased costs with our increased cleaning and other pandemic expenses that we've had. And so, you know, it'll get us through till next year, but definitely won't help us weather this entire crisis.
So when you say get us through, you mean to the end of the fiscal year, the end of June?
We think a little bit past June, but not to the very end of the calendar year.
So, you know, SEPTA is not the only transit agency facing a dire picture, and there's a collaborative effort to win more federal relief money. Unless Congress tacks coronavirus relief onto a spending bill, which must be passed by December 11th, and pandemic relief aid, there is a big if. It could be quite a while before aid is forthcoming. What is the potential fallout?
Sure. Well, look, every option still remains on the table. We are looking at different types of reductions. And obviously, we can only, you know, fund and support, you know, a system that we have the resources for. And so, you know, we're taking a look. We know that if we halt projects and we start eliminating service, which it would include shutting down rail lines, cutting routes, closing stations, reducing staff levels. We know that that impact would also be long-standing because once you take those things away, it costs much more and takes a lot of time to get it back up and running. So we want to make sure that all the elected officials understand that this is not something that you can snap your fingers and turn off, and then when funding comes, you snap your fingers and you turn it back on. That's not how transit works. And we also know that service reductions would be devastating to southeastern Pennsylvania. We might not be there to support all of our employers coming back in the region. We know that we need to be fully functioning in order for everybody to come back and recover as strongly as possible. And so it does definitely have lasting impacts, not even to mention how it impacts the rest of Pennsylvania, for example. We've awarded 19,000 contracts to 989 companies in 38 of the 67 counties in the Commonwealth. That totals $1.3 billion since 2015, and most of that would go away. And so the reach is far larger than just southeastern PA.
At what point will you know definitively when reductions will have to be made?
By the end of this year, if we don't have some federal funding coming our way that we can count on so that we know we can do long-term planning, and also the beginning of next year as far as our capital budget and where we are as far as sustained budgetary needs, we'll have to start reducing.
And what's first on
reductions?
What's first on the chopping block?
We're gathering that information now. Obviously, each option has different impacts as far as financial, as far as how it would impact our system moving forward, as far as how easy or hard it would be to get it back up and running. So we will, evaluate each option and see what would be best with the resources that we have.
My understanding is that some of the regional rail lines, might well be cut.
Yes, that's definitely one of the options we're taking a look at. As we mentioned earlier in this conversation, the regional rail has the lowest ridership right now compared to pre-pandemic levels. And so, that will definitely be looked at, as well as other reduction measures.
Which of the rails are most at risk?
I would say the entire system is really at risk, but regional rail we will definitely take a look at carefully as far as what it will save us and how hard it would be to get back up and running.
Would you consider eliminating any lines entirely?
Yes, that is a possibility. Complete lines could be eliminated. We'll take a look at our bus service, see where we have redundancies with buses, obviously not as convenient to those who are used to using regional rail for certain trips. But we are looking at every option.
There's concern, Leslie Richards, among community activists that Philadelphia's poor would be profoundly impacted by service cuts. It could be a huge challenge for many people to get to work or to access health services or shopping. Will you be able to preserve critical commuter access for those who cannot afford alternatives?
Right. So we will be looking at that for those who need us to do their everyday activities. We know that transit is tied very tightly to quality of life and economic opportunity for all, as well as making sure that the people who need us get to where they need to go, which includes jobs, which includes medical care, which includes, daily errands such as going to the grocery store, the pharmacy. And so we will be taking all of that into account. Reaching those communities is inherent in all of our system. So no matter what gets cut, certain riders are going to lose those options.
Leslie, do SEPTA commuters, especially in communities which would be the most adversely affected, do they have an adequate awareness of the seriousness of the situation?
We'll be talking, just like we're talking to you, we're talking to our advocacy groups, we're talking to our community groups, we're talking to our elected officials. We will be communicating in many different methods and reaching out and definitely doing our best. This will not come as a surprise when we start to make the decisions of what cuts need to be made. And those decisions will be made without any further funding coming our way if that's the situation we find ourselves in.
In August, you went to Harrisburg and spoke before the State House Transportation Committee about long-term funding. In 2022, if I have this correct, under Act 89, yearly funding from the State Turnpike Commission to SEPTA drops from about $178 million to $50 million. How does the loss of this money impact SEPTA, and how are state lawmakers thinking about this?
Right. Well, the impact is huge for us. As the law is written right now, that money transfers from coming from the turnpike to coming from the general fund out of vehicle sales tax. But that money is currently going to other uses, such as, you know, education, such as, prison needs, such as other cabinet needs, health needs, especially, during this pandemic. And so the likelihood of elected officials immediately agreeing to take hundreds of millions of dollars that are now being spent for other very important needs and transferring it all to transit, as it is written in that legislation, is not something we are counting on. And so, we really see our capital budget as having a huge crisis. And just to, make sure that everyone understands, our capital budget is already at half of what our sister agencies of similar sizes, Boston, Chicago, Washington, they all have capital budgets of well over $1 billion. But because of the funding formula for transit in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we are operating at half of what these other agencies are operating at. So any impact to our capital budget is just devastating.
So does it seem inevitable to you then that there will be a downsizing of some sort of the SEPTA system over the next few years?
Without identifying new funding, and I would say new increased funding, yes, I'd say that's probable, highly likely.
So far, there haven't been layoffs among SEPTA employees. Can you continue to forestall this?
We are looking into that right now and seeing again, what our options are. But, reducing staff levels is definitely one of the options we'll be taking a look at.
And fare increases have been postponed for the moment. For how long?
They have been. So the board will be voting in December. They discussed it at the November board meeting of postponing any fare increases until the end of the fiscal year, which would be June 30th of 2021.
Do you think commuters who've become accustomed to working from home during the pandemic will come back after the pandemic recedes?
I do, but I think it's going to take some time. I think people will come back when they're comfortable doing so, when the vaccine is widely available, when other parts of their lives start to feel, I hate to use the word normal, I would say a better normal after this pandemic. I know everyone, that I'm working with, they just miss, being together. They miss what it's like to sit around a table and brainstorm. And also just share, share experiences. Being, on WebEx calls or Zoom calls 8 hours a day is quite exhausting in a way that, is very different than having personal interactions. Now, that's not to say people are going to continue coming, work into an office 5 days a week.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I've got to stop you there, but thank you for joining us. Leslie Richards, SEPTA General Manager. Stay tuned as the regional roundup continues.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For nearly 30 years, New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District has leaned Republican. The late John Adler was elected to just one term as a Democrat in 2009. But this year, Democrat Andy Kim won his second straight term as congressional representative to the 3rd, beating his Republican opponent, David Richter, by a significant margin. The 3rd District covers much of Burlington County in New Jersey, which tilts blue, and parts of Ocean County, which is decidedly red, perhaps a microcosm of the divide facing us across the U.S. And so we thought we'd invite Representative Kim back to the roundup to get his thoughts on what it might take to bring the country together, as well as critical issues facing the incoming Biden administration, including the pandemic, the economy, military withdrawals from Afghanistan and Iraq, and more. Phones are open at 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Great to have you back with us, Andy Kim.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here.
And congratulations on your win.
I appreciate that. I'm very proud of what our team has been able to put together.
Let's begin by discussing the divide that's separating so many of us in this country. You know, President Trump continues to claim he was robbed of a second term. And there are, you know, still people are hanging on to the very, 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 very slim hope that Mr. Trump would somehow prevail. This among bitter differences in political ideology. How do we begin to come together?
Well, we begin to come together by going through the process that our nation has been doing for hundreds of years, which is to have the peaceful transfer of power, to be able to make sure that we can make this transition. Our nation is the richest, most powerful country in the world, with the largest army in the world and the biggest economy in the world. It's going to be a very complicated process to have this type of transition, and it will be, even if both sides are fully cooperating. But the fact that we had this delay, that we're still waiting to see if we are getting the full coordination from the Trump administration, is something that we need to look out for. But the American people need to see that our democracy and the transition of power is still going to proceed in the way that it has for hundreds of years. And that's what I hope to be able to see and be able to show the American people going forward.
As I mentioned a bit earlier, Ocean County, New Jersey is primarily a red county. When you were campaigning, what did you hear from constituents there, many of whom did vote for Donald Trump?
I heard people talking about the issues that they were facing, the challenges that they were facing every single day, about the coronavirus crisis that they're facing and that they're worried about. You know, I just, you know, just experienced something this week that really stuck with me. It was my son's daycare teacher was tested positive for the coronavirus. So we had to go get our kids tested. And thankfully they tested negative. But when I was there, you know, I saw a mother just crying, you know, desperate to try to get her kid an appointment to get tested. I mean, just the struggles that she's had. She's saying that she drove around for hours to be able to find a test that was available. People are scared. People are worried right now. And whether it's about the virus or being able to put food on the table, and just the sheer number of people that we heard about who were going hungry over the Thanksgiving Day week, yeah, that's what people are hearing, talking about. That's what they're worried about. And they're hoping and praying, and like this woman was at this urgent care facility, begging for their leaders to listen to them and try to help solve these problems.
Within the Democratic Party, there is a vibrant discussion, if you will, about whether moderation should be the path forward during the Biden administration. What is your perspective on this?
What I say is that it's, again, coming back to what I just talked about, it's about focusing on the issues that people are facing. It's not about a spectrum. The people in my district, they don't refer to their political beliefs based off of some left to right spectrum of ideology. They talk about it based off of money in their pockets, lost jobs, when they talk about it in terms of their healthcare concerns. And whichever party is able to speak to that and really show that there's follow through, not just talking points, but actual follow through on what it is that these people are concerned about, that's where the focus needs to be. You know, and so it's just about getting that job done and trying to deliver in tangible ways. Now, whichever policies can get implemented, the change that they can make to people's lives here, you know, that's where we should focus on. You know, for me, I was a diplomat before this. I was a career public servant that worked under both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. I'm really not focused at all on this debate about, you know, where on the spectrum we should be operating on, but instead just trying to think about what can we actually get done? Can we get past the infrastructure legislation that we need to, or the opioid crisis legislation we need to? That's what we need to focus on.
So, Andy Kim, you are a member of the House Select Committee on the Coronavirus Crisis. You know, good news, of course, is that a number of vaccines are on the way. the logistics of getting these to most of the American people will largely fall on the Biden administration. Is there indication that the Trump administration will help set the table here for a successful rollout in the spring?
That's what we're waiting to see. I mean, what I have heard is that the Biden team has started to get briefed up by those in the Trump administration working on the coronavirus crisis. That's what I'm hearing through my work on the Select Committee. I've seen the Biden team put together an incredible team of experts, and we'll see how that lines up. But the vaccine side of things, there's two major components here. One is that the Trump administration is still the ones in charge right now, especially over the emergency use authorization at the FDA that would eventually approve this. That needs to make sure it happens quickly, but something that is going to be transparent and accountable to the American people, that they can have faith in that. Because if the Trump administration runs a process that is not one that the American people can have faith in, no Biden administration is going to be able to make up for those types of problems later. So we need to make sure that the career scientists at the FDA are protected and that they are making this decision off of science and facts. And then the distribution of the vaccine has been largely pushed to the states. And that is something that worries me deeply about this problem. Are we actually going to have a national strategy for vaccine distribution, or is it going to be 50 different strategies for all the different states? And that is something that we need to make sure is as rock solid as possible, and that transition is handed over incredibly, incredibly well. So that is something that I'm working on through the work on the Select Committee.
A federal spending bill needs to be in place by December 11th, or there's the risk for a government shutdown. The initial plan could total what? Just under $1.5 trillion. Is it likely more coronavirus relief will be included in this spending plan?
Well, it needs to be in there, and that is something that we're working on. As I mentioned, you know, just the sheer amount of struggles, especially small businesses, you know, restaurants that are the ones that I've been hearing the most from over the last couple of weeks, just really unsure. A lot of them don't think they're going to make it through the winter.
Yeah.
As you know, outdoor seating is just becoming impossible now with the changing of the temperature. So we need to get this done, and we needed to get it done months ago. And this has just been shameful that it's continued on this long. And, you know, just hopefully we can make that type of deal. That is my top priority right now, is trying to deliver that negotiated settlement for us to be able to have more coronavirus relief. So where it stands in terms of probability, I'm not positive right now, but I know that it just needs to get done, and we need to be able to deliver that.
Small businesses, Andy Kim, of course, have been called the backbone of America. Arguably, they have been hit the hardest in the pandemic, or especially hard anyway. You also sit on the House Committee on Small Business. Where is the discussion on programs like the Paycheck Protection Program and also, of course, coronavirus recovery help, you know, on that committee?
Yeah, well, I've been for months now supporting another round of the Paycheck Protection Program. But that in and of itself is not going to be enough. You know, a lot of what we need to focus in on are, where are the people struggling the most? Which small businesses, what sectors, what industries? And as I mentioned, you know, restaurants, bars, and hospitality and others are some of the ones that are hit the hardest right now and struggling, especially as we are engaged in the second wave right now that is beyond proportions. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now in New Jersey, one out of every 582 people in New Jersey has died of this virus. One out of every 1,250 Americans nationwide has died of this virus. It is real, and the pandemic is getting worse and worse and into the second wave right now. And so I'm very worried about the next coming weeks. It could be some of the toughest times that we've had as a country. And we need to make sure that we're geared up for that. I don't see the sense or urgency in D.C. that should exist, the kind of urgency that I saw back in March when we worked together across the aisle to get the CARES Act passed. And that is what I'm urging my colleagues to remember, is that urgency is vivid and real. If not for us, certainly it is for the American people.
Let's get an update on what's happening at the low-security Federal Corrections Institution at Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst, which sits in the 3rd District. Over 200 inmates and a couple dozen staff have tested positive. There are claims that prisoners transferred from a facility in Ohio, which had been struggling with an outbreak, brought the virus with them. There are questions about mitigation protocol at Fort Dix. Are inmates there receiving adequate protection, testing, and in appropriate cases, Andy, a compassionate release?
Yeah. So this is something that I talked to the warden about recently, as well as the regional director for this entire region. I raised those exact questions. They are assuring me there that the testing and the appropriate safety measures are being taken, but we have to make sure that we're staying on top of this. It's one of the largest outbreaks that we see when it comes to the Federal Corrections Department, and it is very worrisome. They put in place a moratorium in terms of transfer of prisoners recently, and I've urged them to continue on with that moratorium going forward. So that's something that I'm staying on top of. But, you know, given just the prevalence of this virus, it's very worrisome. In terms of personal protective equipment, testing, and steps that we can make sure to keep the staff safe, the inmates safe, but also the community around it. You know, this is something I'm very worried about. Is the outbreak and the infection in the facility going to come out into the community surrounding it? So those are all the steps that we're staying on top of here. So I'm going to certainly be having strong oversight over this process personally to try to make sure that that they have everything that they need to be able to handle and mitigate this outbreak.
The Trump administration says it will pull thousands of troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan by January 15th, with the goal to have all remaining troops home by the spring of next year. Again, you served in Afghanistan in the Obama administration as a strategic advisor to Generals Petraeus and Allen, and you also served on the National Security Council regarding Iraq. Andy Kim, few of us would say we wouldn't want our men and women who are serving at home and out of danger, but there are potential pitfalls of this drawdown. Could you weigh in?
Yeah, well, look, I agree with you. I want our service members home as soon as possible. When I was in Afghanistan in 2011 working there, I never imagined that we would still have service members there in 2020. That this war would continue on into its 20th year, that we would have service members serving out in Afghanistan, and I met one of them that wasn't even born on September 11th. Hmm. And so these are just shocking to understand this. What we need to remember is why it is we went out there in the first place, to keep our nation safe, to make sure that we are pushing back and stopping terrorist threats against us before they can hit us in the homeland. That is what I'm focused on. I went out to Afghanistan last year. That threat is real, and it's one that we need to stay on top of. That doesn't mean that we continue to stay there forever. But what we lack right now is a comprehensive strategy that explains how we're going to make sure that we counter this threat in the future, especially if we see the Taliban start to take over large swaths of the country again, as we undoubtedly will, given the dynamics going forward. Worries me significantly.
It's not easy to, if we bring people home, it's not easy to just send them back out.
Well, if we bring them home, we want to make sure that we don't have to send them back out. Yeah. So what I'm looking for, or what are the fail-safe mechanisms? Who is going to be in charge of ensuring that Al-Qaeda or ISIS Khorasan, which is another group there that I'm very worried about, that these are not going to be places where these groups can plot against our homeland? And right now, I don't see those assurances of who is going to be taken on that role.
So would you characterize this as a mistake? The Trump administration's efforts to bring most troops home by the middle of January.
I would say that this is reckless right now during a presidential transition to be taking this type of step right now when we have a new team coming in. You're binding their hands. You're taking the decision away from them for our ability to be able to do that. And we are trying to make sure that this intra-Afghan government dialogue is proceeding. We are taking leverage off the table that could be used for us to be able to ensure that the Taliban doesn't take the kind of steps that we think that they will. And when I was out there and working with Afghan women and children, seeing the progress that was made, and what I worry about is that all going to get erased? Yeah. You know, all these women and these girls that I met in Afghanistan, what's going to happen to their futures? And you know, those are elements that we need to take on and understand what's going to happen. Right now, these are questions without answers. And I find it reckless that the Trump administration has failed to secure those answers and instead putting a lot of this in jeopardy.
So Joe Biden has obviously the U.S. is out of the Iran nuclear pact under the Trump administration. We only have about a minute left, Representative Kim, but obviously things in Iran very unstable right now with the assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Ayatollah Khomeini has vowed revenge. What is the Biden administration facing on Inauguration Day and shortly after with this situation?
Well, what the Biden administration is facing is one of the most strategically important questions facing our country right now, which is how do we stop the Iranian regime from attaining a nuclear weapon? That is as clear as can be. Every decision, whether it's the decision to assassinate an official or the decision to pursue certain diplomatic paths, must be focused on that question. Everything needs to be looking at, does this help or hurt our ability to stop a nuclear weapon? And there are two options, very easy. Is it diplomacy, a peaceful way, or a kinetic way, a military strategy? I, for one, want to see it go down the diplomatic route, because anything otherwise would signify war, and a war that our country cannot afford and does not want to get involved in. So we should be doing everything we can to embolden our ability to solve this diplomatically. That's what the Biden administration wants to do. But I don't get the sense that the Trump administration in these final weeks is committed to that. And that's what worries me.
Quick question for you as we wrap up the conversation. As you mentioned, you served in both the Bush and Obama administrations. You know, President-elect Biden is in the process of putting his administration together. If he were to call, what are your thoughts about serving?
Well, look, my job is to serve the people of Burlington County and Ocean County. And that's what I've committed to doing. I have great respect for the president-elect. I've worked under him before at the White House, and his senior team, like Tony Blinken and others, are mentors of mine. So I will continue to serve with them from my position on Capitol Hill to help them be as successful as possible for America.
All right. Andy Kim, representative for New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, we talk about Philadanco. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Philadanco has long been thrilling audiences with groundbreaking performance as it provides opportunity for Black ballet dancers. The Philadelphia Dance Company was formed in 1970 by Joan Myers Brown. And now, 50 years later, Brown says it's time to begin the process of succession. Her assistant artistic director, Kim Bears Bailey, will assume the title of artistic director as Brown maintains a presence as Philadanco's founder and artistic advisor. And as we head toward the new year, the challenges are formidable. Like many artistic entities, Philadanco has been hit hard by the pandemic with canceled performances and a free fall in income. But the company is preparing for a return in 2021. And it is our pleasure now to introduce the founder of Philadanco, Joan Myers Brown. Hello, Joan, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you.
And also with us, Assistant Artistic Director and soon-to-be Artistic Director, Kim Bears Bailey. Welcome to you as well, Kim.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Joan, first to you. Tell us about the impact Philadanco has had on Philadelphia's dance culture over the course of 50 years.
Well, I can't really tell you about the impact. All I can say is it's been a lot of hard work for 50 years trying to maintain a company and to give opportunities for youngsters that probably would not have had careers or our chances to move on. All of them don't become dancers, but a lot of people become good people. So I think Philadanco has made its mark in Philadelphia.
You've apparently been talking about a succession plan, Joan, for a few years, but now that the time to step back is really, it's here after a half century at the helm, would you characterize the moment as bittersweet?
Well, you know, I don't think I'll ever step totally out of the picture because this is my life, this company and my schools. But I know that if something should happen to me because of my age or because of the times, that things have to be in place to continue. So I don't want people to say, what's going to happen now that Joan is gone? You know, I want things to be ready that if Joan isn't here, that things can operate and continue to move smoothly.
Kim Bears Bailey, you are no newcomer to Philadanco. You've been a part of the company for 40 years. I think a dancer for 20 of them. You know, it's a tough time to be taking the helm of a dance company during, you know, we're in a pandemic, of course. What are the primary challenges facing Philadanco moving forward?
Well, like Ms. Brown said, right now it's the halt of performances and traveling, the things that are part of the product of the company. And so we have to kind of rethink and re-envision where we go from here in this pandemic. My primary goal is keeping the dancers encouraged, on top of their game, inspired to want to go further. They're committed. They're here. And just, you know, every day we face a new challenge with this COVID. And so we want to stay and maintain our artistic excellence, which has never wavered. And we want to make sure that people know that we're still here.
Joan, how about philanthropic help? Has it in general been available to Philadanco over the years?
Well, locally, it fluctuates, you know, it fluctuates for all the arts, but more so for the arts of color, artists of color. We always find that we are in a separate pot or at the end of the totem pole. And so it's been hard. It fluctuates. I've been lucky lately to have garnered the support of more national organizations like the Doris Duke Foundation and the Mellon Foundation picked up. They don't ask the questions that Philadelphians use as excuses to not fund us. So, but I think that's going to change. I think that the pandemic has made people aware how important the arts are and of our contributions and how valuable we are.
Kim, you want to weigh in?
Yes, indeed. I think this unfortunate president at times really does reflect how much people missed the arts and what it does to their life, their everyday joy. And that's what we do. That's what we bring to our audience. And in this, there is that bit of light that's saying that we need this. So I agree with Ms. Brown that people will indeed come to the support of these organizations like Philadanco.
So do you see support such as philanthropic support increasing for Black companies, Black artistic entities like Philadanco?
Well, recently, you know, I want to interject on that, Kim, because I don't think this is something that she knows. But recently, the state of Pennsylvania gave out 164 grants for arts organizations across the state. And in the entire state, only three groups of color got money out of 164. So, and then when we look at, of course, I can't compare our budget to the major ballet companies, but when they get $500,000 and we get $30,000, you know, the inequities still exist. So, you know, the value of what we do to our community is always played down, but they will give millions of dollars or thousands of dollars to a white organization to do exactly what we do, and we can't get funded for it. So the inequities, you know, that we have to call it out, say what it is, and demand change. And that's what I've been doing for the last 50 years.
Kim, as the pandemic rages on, let's talk about your reference early about the dancers and kind of keeping them ready to perform once again. Are you at full company size at Philadanco right now? Have you had to cut back?
We are 12 members strong, and that's been over the last couple of years. It does offer an opportunity for us to be able to kind of get an intimate connection with one another so that the dancers are, again, prepped and ready for when that time when the curtain will arise again. Of course, in these times of non-funding, it does offer you an opportunity to not be able to build the way you want to build in terms of numbers.
How are dancers staying in shape? Have you worked out a distancing protocol so that people can actually get together and see each other on stage and
we do
work
virtual
with each other?
Every week we're on virtual. We've done classes on virtual. We've even done some rehearsals. The choreographer is virtual. You know, we're resilient in that we find a way to make a way so that we can continue to be our best selves. And so with that, and the dancers, of course, in their own individuality, their schedules, they're teaching, they're doing their own classes, they're maintaining their own regiments. And so we come together as a collective in a virtual setting because one is safe and two, want to make sure we follow all the CDC guidelines.
You know, we just recently did the parade for the Thanksgiving parade with two of my dancers, and we did a concert with the Annenberg Center, which was live. They filmed it live. So, you know, people find ways of, as I think Kim said, resilience, or things to keep things going so that the dancers don't get discouraged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't want to leave and look for another job right now because there are no jobs for them. Even Broadway is not working. So the dancers are trying to maintain what we have so that once we are asked to go back full, we're ready and we're still in shape.
And you're looking ahead to 2021. So if everything falls together, Joan, what can we expect from Philadanco in terms of performance? What's ahead?
Well, of course, this is our 20th anniversary for the Kimmel Center. We are the resident modern dance company there. We will perform there twice a year if they allow the Kimmel to open. If not, then we will probably be doing some outdoor things. Once the weather changes, we'll probably try to do some concerts outdoor. And then we have some things that we do residencies with colleges and other performing arts centers where we do virtual classes from here to there, or I'm on panels, or I'm Kim and I are talking. The Dance Magazine Awards are next week. I'm an awardee. A presenter. I have to make awards for that. So there are lots of things that continue to go on. And, you know, as they fall into place, you try to adjust and make it work.
Kim Bears-Bailey, are there new ballets being developed that, you know, reflect the tumultuous year we are in right now? The events, including obviously widespread illness, the pandemic, social justice, you know, the election. What's in the pipeline?
In the pipeline, we had four choreographers that we were working with in our 50th anniversary: Ray Mercer, Bakari Lindsay, Catherine Smith, and Tang Dao, and two of the choreographers we've worked with in the past that come with rich, rich choreographic depth that does speak to where we are, social distancing, how we're dealing with each other in this distance climate. And then we have new choreographers that are there just to present dance of beautiful works and collectives of musical creativity. And so we're looking forward to that time when we can present these works to our audience,
Joan,
hopefully in 2021.
This question to you, Joan. Let's talk about what Philadanco has brought to the community, thinking of, you know, the widespread poverty in Philly, and wondering about whether the company has provided opportunities to kids who are interested in dance but who simply, you know, can't afford what their wealthier peers elsewhere can manage.
Well, fortunately for us, this Dr. Rush Bartle Foundation is one of the foundations that make sure that the kids in Philadelphia have opportunities through Philadanco. We have two schools that give classes every week, and now we're closed, but we have four companies starting with 8 to 10-year-olds. Then we have another group, 12 to 15. Then we have our pre-professional group. Then we have the company, the ones that are on salary and get paid every week. So we are busy with dance in Philadelphia. I've been teaching. My school is 60 years old. I was teaching before I had a company. So my companies in school have been in the community. I have over 600 kids in my school. So we are busy in the community. Everybody will say to me, either I went to Philadanco, or my sister went to Philadanco, or I know somebody who went to Philadanco. So Philadanco is steadfast in the community.
Joan and Kim, you've worked together for so long. How do you view your relationship? Joan, you first.
Well, it's a partnership. We agree it's a partnership. Kim has another obligation. She's on the staff at the University of the Arts. And so I limit up until now what I was going to demand of her or the kind of responsibility she would have, because she had to decide where she wanted to go in her career after she graduated from college. And, you know, she wanted to, she has a family. So then we had to sit down and say, "What? How much of this do you want to do? How much are you willing to take on?" I work 15 hours a day. I don't expect anyone else to do that. But it's my baby. So I have to say, how much of my baby am I giving up right now? Am I going to give up? I don't need a part-time babysitter, or do I need a pull-down babysitter? So it's quite a responsibility. And we're learning day to day with each other. And she has been my right hand. Absolutely. I tell everyone she's been doing 80% of my work before I changed titles.
So, Kim, how do you view your relationship? I've read that you call Joan Aunt Joan.
Actually, I call her Mom.
Okay.
And I'm Joan. But like she said, it is indeed a partnership. It's a mentorship. You know, people think that just because this title has come to fruition that it's something new. But I've been groomed since I've been here. Like you said, I'll be here 40 years in January. And that's what happens here. That's the beauty of what happens at Filadenko. If you stay long enough and you want and you show signs of wanting to get deeper into the organization, it's right there for you. You're being groomed. You're being taught. You're being shaped and molded. And so for me, it's a continuum up the ladder. And I'm so grateful to be a part of the continuum and the legacy of Joan Myers. But like she said, she's here. She's not going anywhere. And this is her vision. And anyone that wants to be a part of making sure that vision stays at the forefront, that's what we're all about here at Filadenko.
You have both danced. Describe what it takes to produce the moment on stage in which it all comes together. Kim?
Let Kim do that, because I haven't been on a stage in years.
It's a lot of hard work, sweat and tears, joy, passion, dedication, commitment. And that's what the dancers, that's part of their DNA when they walk in here. The bar is set high, and their job is to make sure they obtain that and succeed in that. And they do. They do. That's why they stay. And we're so fortunate that these dancers have decided in these challenging times to stay and be a part of this organization that they love so much. But it's a lot of hard work. But when you see that curtain open and you see the joy that they bring on people's faces and you see their artistic creativity just flourish under the lights, that's why we do what we do. That's exactly why we do what we do.
And Joan, when you experience that moment on stage, when you see that moment on stage, what is that experience like for you?
Well, usually I stand in the back of the audience and I watch the curtains open and close. I see the people stand up and applaud. Those are my moments of joy. And to see the dancers have an opportunity to do what they want and how hard they work to make sure that it happens. Those moments of joy for me are different because I'm on this side of the stage. Sometimes I'm backstage running, helping, fixing costumes, making quick changes, but most of the time, my joy is letting them be themselves and have the opportunity to do what they want to do.
So step one, to ensure that those moments of joy continue to happen. Kim, what are some of the initial steps that you might be taking as the new artistic director of Filadenko?
Well, right now it's a continuum. Since we were working with these four choreographers, I'm engaged with them on a regular so that we understand where their artistic journey is going with us, so that we don't miss a beat when we come out of this. And even with our O-Rep, we want to stay on top of it. So we want it to be a smooth transition and something that's so kind of rocky right now.
Well, listen, best of luck to you, Kim Bears-Bailey, incoming artistic director of Filadenko. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
And Joan Myers Brown, founder of Filodanco, thanks so much for coming on with us. It was great.
And thank you for the opportunity to talk about what we do. We appreciate it.
It was our pleasure. And this reminder, you can find us here at the Regional Roundup on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez, our producer, John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for tuning in, and be well.